Just out of interest, I always think it's fascinating. How many of you have been in Moody Church in Chicago? Anybody? Look at that. There's a couple people. Isn't that fascinating? Like, what church in the world can you go anywhere in the world and say, well, have you been to Moody Church? And it's just crazy. Everybody's been to Moody Church. So Warren Wiersbe was the pastor there before. Lutzer just retired. Ironside. Funny story. There was a guy coming. Some of you know the story. From an FIEC church. I don't remember which one it is. I think it's in Glasgow. Coming from an FIEC church to Moody Church to either be the pastor or teach a series of meetings. The story's told one of different ways. And on the way, he gets on the boat named the Titanic, and he dies on the Titanic on the way to Moody Church. So we'll always have that. I'm hoping on the way home from FIEC that nothing happens. So what, I want to be unapologetic before you that I think that relevant ministry is an appropriate missiological decision, that when people walk into your church, they say, these people are radically different, but what makes them radically different is not cultural, but gospel. Let me give you an example. A very famous author by the name of James Michener, he wrote a book called Hawaii. He wrote a bunch of books, but one book called Hawaii. And in the book called Hawaii, he traces over multiple generations. This is what he does. He writes like Boston or whatever it may be, and he traces it over multiple generations. And the book Hawaii traces it over multiple generations. And he starts with the missionaries showing up in Hawaii. And the missionaries show up, or maybe probably before that, I just remembered from that point. And the missionaries showed up, and they met the natives on the shore. And the missionary men had, the black suits with the black hats, the big thick black, the black rimmed hats, and the women had the hoop skirts and the bonnets. And so they come ashore, and they're met by the natives, right? And the natives had grass skirts and strategically placed coconuts, and you don't hear a lot, but the missionaries are there, and they're carrying the big black Bible. And so then they're going to share the gospel with these, and it's actually pretty true to form what actually happened. So what happens is then it flashes back, I don't know how many years later, but a few years later, and now all the missionaries, or all the natives you saw in the grass skirts and and with no shoes and all that stuff, now they're going to church. They built a church in the English style on the beach, right near the beach, and all the natives are now kind of making their trek to church, but guess what? Now they're wearing hoop skirts. The women are wearing hoop skirts. They look very uncomfortable. Wearing hoop skirts, and the men have black hats. But you can tell they're the same people, the Hawaiian natives that they met on the beach. And they're carrying their big Bibles, and they look a lot less happy than they did before. That's the part that Michener sort of may add in, the lack of happiness. And so they go in. Now, here's historically what happens is, people do respond to the gospel because the god emperor of Hawaii had just fallen. Their religion was in disarray. And so a lot of people became Christians along the coast, but Hawaii didn't experience a lot of evangelistic response on the inland. But you gotta ask why. Why did the gospel slow from the coast to the inland? Well, here's why. Because very soon, most of the people in the rest of the Big Island knew, this is key, how you became a Christian. So how did you become a Christian? Think about it. What would the perception of people inland be about how you become a Christian when they saw what happened to the people along the coast? You change your clothes. Exactly. That's, by the way, what's called obscurantism. It's when you practice your faith in such a way that you obscure the truth of the gospel because people see you and think something else is the gospel because you are so culturally different rather than biblically different. Now, so when someone walks into your church, does the ministry engagement there, do they say, there are people like me here, they're just radically changed by the gospel here? If not, and they all have a common characteristic, people are going to assume. Let me tell you my challenge right now, right? In the States, it's evangelicalism and republicanism. So if you're a Christian who's an evangelical, you vote for Donald Trump. It's pretty much overwhelmingly the case, white evangelicals. So what happens is now, and this is what I wonder post-election, what this is going to look like, when people are sharing the gospel who say, you know what, I don't want to be a Republican, and Donald Trump has largely undermine so many of the values that... So you got the evangelical candidate has said some things. I mean, during the last debate, I had to ask my children to leave the room so I could watch the debate. That's quite a shift. So what does this impact? See, but this is the danger of being tied to one party. So irrelevant ministry is often causes people to think, oh, being a Christian is something other than someone changed by the blood-bought gospel. Does that make sense? I'm going to give you a chance to ask questions about that in a few minutes. Pride is another issue that often becomes the case. Now, you remember Harold. Harold stood up at that meeting at Rolling Fields, and his words were, we don't want our church to die. We'll do what it takes. That's what he said to me. And depending on the church, it needs more or less change depending upon its situation, right? Some churches just need refocusing. They're stagnant inside, need a clear focus on outreach. Some basically need restarting. They're near death. Restart with new leadership, become a new church. And there's different levels sort of between the two. Now, let me jump forward. Again, I'm going to give you all this sort of stuff, but let me jump forward a little bit because I want to talk to a couple things about what a turnaround actually looks like, right? Few things that are key, and then I'm going to go to revival, then I'm going to go to planting, and then I'm going to take your questions and just dialogue with you as long as you'd like. First, the people have to be part of any turnaround of a church. I've never seen a church that successfully changed that didn't have the people a part of it. Now, I think that there's a diversity of practice here among the FIEC churches. I think some of you are congregational. I think some of you are more elder-led. Some is elder-ruled, I think. If I'm wrong, it doesn't matter for the sake of this, because my point is this. When it comes to church revitalization, everybody's congregational because people vote with their feet. And if you got 50 people in your elder rule, you're going to tell them what to do. They're going to decide to do it or not do it. And the reality is you need to find a way to help people get a vision together. So what we did, the reason I walk Rolling Fields through that process of seeing our neighborhood, of seeing what worship approaches look like, is so that they together could decide. So we voted one day on the kind of church we were going to be. How are we going to do this? What are we going to be like? So we voted, and when we voted, I actually, for example, on the worship style, I asked them to vote. There were the four styles of worship I talked about yesterday. I said, we're going to vote, and everybody gets three votes. It's like a Chicago election. Everybody gets three votes, dead people included. And so I said, first, I want you to vote, and I want you to say, of the worship styles we participated in, what was most moving to you? And overwhelmingly, they picked traditional, right? So older congregation, I picked traditional. I thought I was the best one. Pipe organ, bum, bum, da, da, it was great. I said, number two, what worship style do you think would be most culturally appropriate for people in this neighborhood to worship God in spirit and truth? And overwhelmingly, they picked four, which was the contemporary style of worship. And I said, okay, so now here's the big question. Going forward, let's choose together what God's calling us to do. We prayed, we sought the Lord, and they overwhelmingly voted for the same thing. You say, well, what's that same thing? Because you'll do that. No, I don't want you. I don't want to tell you because you don't live in their community, right? There's no such thing as Christian music. There's only Christian lyrics, right? God can and does use any form of music for his glory and honor except country western. But that's because he's a loving God, and he loves and cares for you and wouldn't do that to you. I lived in Nashville until just a few months ago, so imagine how that went over. So again, that's just one example, but people were part of that. So at every stage, when we decided to redo some of the facilities, when we decided to change some of the outlook of our setting, then we decided on a course of action together. We actually put together a team. So this is our revitalization plan. So I didn't say, let's go. We said together, let's roll. And there's a distinction between the two. We had to come to an agreement that this was the plan we're going to do. And then we proactively looked at leadership. Listen, you're going to have opposition when you lead a church in revitalization. It's just part of it. If you went into ministry thinking that nobody would ever dislike you, you've chosen poorly. The reality is if 10% of your church isn't mad at you for some reason, you're probably not doing anything significant. Now, if 70% is mad at you, you need to stop. You need to slow down and bring them along. But having people unhappy is part of the life journey that we're actually on as leaders. Leaders don't make everybody happy, right? That's part of it. So one of the things we found was just so how central in church civilization, how central leadership actually was. So comeback leaders took the initiative for change. They brought people along. They challenged excuses. Let me give you an example. So I'm at Moody Church, and Moody Church has been plateaued or declined for a few decades. And I'm just the interim. You know, interim doesn't fix everything. And my job is to get people used to somebody other than the pastor who's been there for 37 years, right? So amazing man, Urban Lutzer, he retired. And so my job is just, I've talked faster than he does. I'm more humorous than he was. He was Canadian. I'm a New Yorker. I can assure you that's a difference. And so part of my job is to help make that transition. But one of the things also I'm trying to do is I have to challenge some excuses. Because people say, and it's interesting how it works. I was talking to the staff, and I said, "We got to grow. We got to reach people. I mean, that's a big part of what God's called us to do." And they say, "Well, you know, some of them, and some people say, well, we just feel we can't. I mean, we've just been stuck. We don't have parking, or you know, all the things. We're right downtown. Chicago. I mean, high skyscrapers all around. We're right in the CBD, equivalent of, I guess, in downtown London. And And so I said, but there's a church right next to us, just got planted, right? There's a church that it's called Community Christian Church, and it's literally, I mean, you know, you heard people say I could throw a rock. Well, this literally, you could throw a rock and hit the church. I was there, I visited with them, and they've grown to 300 in just like 3 years. And it's interesting that the response is almost always, well, but they're not clear on the gospel. Okay. So everybody who's growing is not clear on the gospel. In other words, we disqualify everybody that's reaching people that we're not. Remember Spurgeon's quote. We're going to get back to Spurgeon's quote. Okay. So then I said to them, because I was ready, I had this in my pocket. Okay, but didn't we plant a church called Park Church that's now grown to thousands of young adults that's reaching people right in the community around us? And then they said, yeah, but they had different resources than we did. So is every opportunity going to be roadblocked by some reason, or could we ask, what should we do in this time and in this way to push aside the excuses and say, we can reach some people? Every church can reach some people. Now, mind you, again, it can be a church of 20, it can be a church of 30, it can be a church of 100, but we've got to challenge the excuses that perpetually keep us at a place where we think we can't reach people. Jesus says to pray for the Lord said workers in the harvest. He says the harvest is plentiful, but the workers few, which leads us back to Matthew chapter 9, to pray this regularly and passionately for in the era of church evangelization. See the harvest come from there as well, right? Now, again, some things for us and church evangelization is for you to model evangelism. Wow, that's irritating. Hi. I think somebody's been playing with my PowerPoint. I think my assistant just lost her job. That's okay. I think I'm actually using an older one that I didn't intend to use, but same content. So model evangelistic passion. Can I just ask you to talk about it, talk about it often, talk about how you share the gospel. Let me give you an example. Just out of interest, how many of you know who Bill Hybels is? Raise your hand for just a second. Okay. How many of you have heard Bill Hybels talk about his sailboat? Raise your hand for just a second. Okay. Half the people in the room. Now, why is it weird that we hear that Bill Hybels has a sailboat? My book, if I can encourage you, if you're a pastor, don't tell everyone you're rich and you're going around in a sailboat. You know, I mean, but why have we heard about Bill Hybels' sailboat? Anybody? Go ahead.
How he evangelizes.
And he's story after story about it. Now, again, what did I show you in there a few minutes ago? My neighborhood. I don't have a sailboat, but I got neighbors. And so what Bill Hybels is doing, right, is modeling evangelistic passion. Now, let's think of some of our theological heroes. One of the things that saddens me is most of our theological heroes, I can't think of an example of how they're doing that. They don't have a sailboat, right? And so, but I want to hear more about their neighbor, because I know many of them are deeply passionate about it. Mark Dever does this actually more than most. But I want to hear more consistently about how they're modeling an evangelistic passion in their lives. Now, one of the things that concern me in our world right now, it seems that all of our Reformed friends are now all of a sudden writing books on evangelism as if we're doing it super well, so we should tell the whole rest of the world how to do it. Can I just tell you, there's a lot of great books on evangelism already out there. It's a sign of pride that we can't read them unless they're written by our authors. Now, I think it's good. I mean, I'm not opposed to it. I think it's good. But I think ultimately, it's a little bit like me right now, weight loss. I mean, there are things that I need to get better at before I tell everyone else how to do it. Right? So what I would say is, I think ultimately, one of the things that maybe right here will do, and I promise you, if you will do this, I will, and you're open to it, I'll highlight you on Christianity Today. I'll tell your story. And if you'll find ways to elevate the evangelistic passion in FIEC churches, because I want the evangelistic heroes to be theologically driven heroes, not the other way around. And I think I can find some. I think I can find some examples. So let's share the ministry. This is a key thing. They share the ministry with others. When there's a shift towards church revitalization, they share the ministry with others well. Let me share a couple of things. These are some things that we talked to pastors in our research project that experienced revitalization. It'd make choices about how to invest your time. One of the things that's really tricky for a lot of people is to say, you know what, I'm going to spend time doing certain things, and I'm going to spend other time not doing other things, and I'm going to prioritize my time. Now, I actually encourage church planters to spend in their time divide their time into four quartiles, about 10 to 15 hours a week in each, and for 10 to 15 of those hours to be, if you're planting a church, you should spend 10 to 15 hours a week spending time meeting people, evangelizing, and building relationships. For a lot of people, that's kind of an overwhelming amount of time. That's an overwhelming number of hours. And what I would say to you is if you will practice it, it will not be. Now, I'll tell you what I do and our staff, right? So we meet, our staff meets, and here's what I do, is when we gather together, I ask them, I go around the room and I say, tell me who you shared the gospel with this week, and tell me who you shared the gospel with this week. And if the answer is nobody, we don't, you yell at them or say mean things about them, but there's an expectation in the course of our life we could carve out enough time to share the gospel with at least one person during a given week. You say, Ed, won't that feel forced? You know, I used to speak, I still do sometimes, speak at a seminary, and this seminary, they actually required you once a week to share the gospel. And the students would always complain, oh, it feels so forced. But they every week, because they would be asked, they would come in, did you share the gospel this week? And the students got in the rhythm of it. And you know, those students are some of the most evangelistic pastors I've ever met. Everywhere I go, the graduates of Mid-America Seminary is the name of the seminary. Everywhere I go, Mid-America graduates are leading the way, consistently sharing the gospel. So again, share the ministry, make a choice about how to invest your time. Give away non-ministry tasks are key. Giving away non-ministry tasks are key. You want to focus on delegating to others. These are all things that are there. I mentioned using your time intentionally is kind of a key thing. And spend more time on the people stuff. As a matter of fact, if you're jotting notes down, there are two groups of people as a church revitalizer, actually as really any pastor or church planner, whatever, you need to spend more time with probably. They are your leaders and the lost. What happens is kind of you get leaned on by a lot of people and minister to them, and that's great. But spend more time with people stuff that's primarily your leaders or the lost. Now, when I was planting this church in Nashville, I was actually full-time in another job. So I was director of a research firm called Lifeway Research. But I started that Bible study in my home. I drew on the board. And I eventually just said, let's start a church together. And we started a church. And that church now is, we got a couple of campuses. The pastor's down there, his name is Jimmy Disney. That's really his name, is Jimmy Disney. He gets discounts at Disney World. But he's pastor of church, doing a great job. Talked to him a couple days ago. But here, my role was real simple. So I had to do three things in the life of the church. Number one, I preached at first three out of four Sundays. Now, mind you, I was a volunteer. I wasn't paid by this church to be the lead pastor. So, because I had a job. So, and it's nice when you have a job, you can do that. So I was an unpaid volunteer lead pastor. So I said, there's only three things I can do. I can teach the Word of God three out of four Sundays. That's how we started, number one. Number two, I can meet the staff. So I met the staff weekly, and then the executive pastor largely led the staff, but I was there, spoke into the lives, spoke into the ministry, et cetera, et cetera. Number three, I led a small group in my home. So that neighborhood that you saw, I moved the small group actually started in the home of the first family I led to the Lord, and then we ended up moving into my house just because it was easier, and so we're two houses down, so we stayed there. Why? And people ask me why. I mean, why would you? And I practice this on Sunday night. I am in my neighborhood. I am there. Why? Because that's the place where I get to do the ministry I love the most. I sometimes would tell people I largely pastored this church because of two men named Bruce and Jason. I led them both to the Lord and discipled both of them. And just to see what the Lord has done in their lives, they're both in our small group, really just was deeply meaningful to us. But for me, all I have is 10 hours a week. I get 10 to 12 hours a week to do everything I do for Grace Church as a volunteer. 10 to 12 hours a week. So I can prepare my sermons in 10 to 12 hours a week. Got to meet the staff within 10 to 12 hours a week. And I've got to do this. And I will tell you, I would never let go of what we're doing with our small group because it's there where I'm doing the people stuff. I'm discipling leaders. And now when I left, those guys are actually leading different small groups as well. So don't undervalue the small in the church revitalization endeavor. Is that you might start with a small group of people who get the vision and begin to move forward there. And that leads to the vision, is you want to communicate a clear and compelling vision for change. Now, if you're going to change, I mean, that's what change is. Church revitalization is change. It's stopping the way you're doing some things and starting new ways to do things. Now, you remember at the end of the story, Harold came up to me and poked me in the chest. Ready? Are you ready? It's going to be painful. Is that like assault in the UK? Okay, and your laws are a little tighter than ours. Is that okay? I wasn't sure. So he pokes me right there. But he ends with, it was worth it all. right? So, but why? Because when we went on this journey, Harold got and helped the church to get that we were going to a different future where we're actually reaching young families, their kids, their grandkids, their great-grandkids, and the church would be a different kind of church. But there's pain to get there. It's difficult to get there, right? And people don't change because they don't like pain, right? So what happened was, I'll give you an example. I was calling on them to reprioritize some things in the church, to have an outward focus, outwardly facing focus. The jet lag is just wearing me out right now, sorry. And no Diet Coke on this whole country. And tea, anyway. But a little bitter. But they had to make a change, and it was hard because people gave up long-standing things that were important to them. Let me give you an example. We had a 5-minute thing in every service called Concerns of the Church. So every service, someone would say, "Any concerns of the church?" And which is just the dumbest thing I ever heard of, because everybody decided to bring up some of their complaints about the church. The first Sunday I was there, any concern of church, and Martha stands up and says, "This church is filthy. Someone should be cleaning this church." And then this kid gets, "Well, I am." And that was awkward, you know, and it was like, "But it's filthy." And so one of the first things I did is say, "We're going to quit doing that." But that served a purpose. You know, almost everything a church does serves a purpose. And that became sort of a time to talk about things and, you know, share things, share concerns, share feelings. So change needed to come. Now, change is hard because I actually know this personally. So I have funny shaped feet. I have on both of my feet sort of a little bone that sort of protrudes out right there. I actually see that. And this will actually wear out. It's not yet. These are a newer pair. But it hurt. When I get new shoes for 2 weeks, I have blisters. And I had a podiatrist said, "I can fix that. Just snip that right off." I'm like, I'll stick with the blisters. So I wear the same shoes forever. When they wear out, I just keep wearing them. They'll get a hole right here, and I'll keep wearing them, and then this will start wearing out, and there'll be holes. You know, by the time winter comes around, it's like I'm walking on sock. And I'll walk into, you know, I live in Chicago now, so it's colder, but in Nashville, we still get cold winters, and so I'd step into a puddle of water, and the water would rush up in between my toes, because there's no shoe there, right? It's not just a sock with my Magellan inserts, and it would hurt. And it would hurt. Like, and my wife's like, she'd been telling me for weeks, "You got to get a new pair of shoes, honey." And I'm like, "I don't want to." And then finally I will. Here's why I do. Because when you get freezing cold water between your toes, it's hurt. It's pain. And here's what. Then I change. Because I know it's going to hurt a little, but that hurts more. Here's the thing I don't want you to miss. People never change until the pain of staying the same grows greater than the pain of change. And then you combine that with their kind of heartfelt religious practices. They sort of love the way they do church more than people they're trying to reach. Then what happens is, and this is so key. Almost every church, when given the choice, will choose their traditions over their grandchildren over time. Now, mind you, you don't have to have that choice. You can actually have biblically faithful, gospel-driven ministry that engages different generations. But you have to cast a vision of getting there so people are willing to make the change that will hurt, but for them to make the change that's necessary to move forward. All right, so I've said enough about church revitalization. I'm going to give you the opportunity to ask questions, and then I'm going to change gears, and I'm going to talk about ultimately zero in on church planting for a while. Because they wanted me to do both. I hope that wasn't too overwhelming for you. But if you're a church planter, you're going to need these skills as well, and I can make it applicable both directions. What questions might you have about church revitalization? And we have a microphone. Oh, I thought you were standing to ask a question. That was very formal. Is that a British thing? I love the way you guys do it. Like the guy saying, "I rise to say so-and-so," and you're all supposed to yell at me. We love watching that. Is that Parliament? That's the coolest thing ever. I would like to yell at some political officials. Go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you on that one. Yeah. The last sentence that you just said to us said, you know, about the pain of staying the same grows greater than staying the same. Have you ever actually said that to a church as a kind of provocation?
Yeah. Yeah. Me? Provocative? I actually have. What I say to him is very casual. I say, "Listen, I can't lead you anywhere you don't want to go. And I know this is going to be a painful change, some of the changes that we need to make. But I think we're experiencing a greater pain that we look around and this room is full with people in their 70s and their 80s. And I know that grieves you. I stood up, so I'm a Southern Baptist, and I know we have a Southern Baptist brother over here as well, you know. And so I preached at the Southern Baptist Convention. I guess I preached at the Southern Baptist Convention 5 times. But the first time was 2007, and I got up, and I looked across the room. There were 5,000, 10,000 pastors there. And I said, we got to make some changes that are going to be hard because we've preached away a whole generation of young pastors. I said, look around this room. Look, go ahead and do it. Look at all of the gray hair. Thank God for gray hair. But that's all we have. I said, this is the only place I go every year where it makes me feel young and thin. Were you there that year? No, yeah. They laughed. And then they went, hey, what did he just say? But I got to tell you know what caused Southern Baptists to make a substantive shift was their statistics. See, 2007 was the year that I got up. I was in charge of Southern Baptist stats. And I got up and said, this is the beginning of a decades-long decline because of the trends. It's what we call the percent of membership shift from year to year. And they were mad at me in 2007. In 2008, they declined faster. In 2009, they declined more. And then 2010, 11. And then finally they said, you know what? Maybe there's something going on here. We need a shift in the way that we do ministry and mission. And so part of what my job was as a Southern Baptist statistician was to tell the truth. Facts are our friends. Math doesn't care about your feelings. But ultimately, it became part of the pain because Southern Baptists really care. I mean, Baptists love baptism so much that they named their denomination after it. So when you have less baptisms every year and you're called Baptist, that really bugs you. And so the pain grew and grew and grew until the change was willing to come. And now Southern Baptists are very focused on church planning. They need a clear focus on evangelism, but they're getting there, but very focused on church planning in a way that they weren't. They were, I mean, 10 years ago, they were going to war with their next generation. How dare you be contemporary? Well, now the shift has actually come. So the pain, yeah, so I do sit in front of groups and churches and others. Somebody else, and he'll get you the microphone. Right over here. Oh, y'all over here, and then we'll go this way.
Thanks. This might be taking us off in a different direction.
No worries.
If so, that's fine. But you mentioned near the end there about developing ways of having kind of church gatherings that actually meet the needs of a whole range of people rather than just zeroing in and on kind of one generation or something. And in our church at the moment, we're talking about that. And there's a great concern about, well, if we just focus on like reaching the young people, aren't we going to, you know, just kind of... Yeah. present a consumerist thing for a small group that actually doesn't meet the needs of the whole community. Do you have any insights or big principles about how we can actually, as churches, gather in ways that we're feeding newcomers and young people and old people and doing that whole thing? Because that's a big target. You know?
It is. But the word you used was so good, consumerist, okay? The irony, though, is that in using the word, not in a bad sense, because I would use it the same way. You said, you know, do we just do a consumerist thing? You're already doing a consumerist thing. The people who attend your church like the way you do church, and they're coming there because they like it that way. If you change it, they may leave your store and go to somebody else's store. So I think it's real. See, what the tendency is, I use the same language you would, is what we tend to think of is churches that are doing it differently than what we're doing are actually doing it to appeal to the customer service needs of people. But what we're doing is the way it should be done. Well, the reality is, I was with a Lutheran group recently, and they're quite a party, and... They're like, oh, we couldn't do it like those secret churches. Well, I don't think a secret church has been being a secret church for about 10 years. Everyone decided that didn't work 10 years ago. But they don't want to be like those secret churches. But you know what? People are going to Lutheran churches because they love liturgy and they're customers of liturgy. And so any expression of worship attracts its own customers. I mean, that just is what it is. I don't like that, but it's just statistically what it is. But our job is not to develop customers or consumers of religious goods and services. It's to raise up co-laborers in the gospel. So the question I try to ask is, and this ultimately gets down to what it is that what is church for? Is church for Christians? Which is what a lot of people in the Reformed world would say. It's not what I would say, it's not what Keller would say, not what others would say. I don't think it's for unchurched people, which is what some of the secret church people would say. I think church is for God's glory to be expressed and God's mission to be advanced. And so, therefore, it includes primarily a focus on Christian. But we know at least two occasions, Paul writes, keep in mind, these non-Christians who are here. So there are some things that take place. So, for example, in preaching, I want preaching that's not seeker-driven. I want preaching that's seeker-comprehensible, though. I want people to show up in my church to hear us teach through the Word of God and not say, I have no earthly idea what those words meant. So when we use words, right, so I recently preached about inaugurated eschatology at Moody Church, right? And I told them, listen, if you can order coffee at Starbucks, you can learn some theological language at church. It's just a language like venti latte or whatever ultimately those things are called. So I'm looking for on-ramps to bring people on to a greater sense of theological depth. So, but back to your, just the heart of your question is, how do we create a church? And probably it's going to boil down to worship style in many cases, but not all. And what I would say is there's a bit of a recognition that that churches have changed. And there are bridges that we can use. Keith Getty, who's a good friend of mine, is kind of been a bridge person for some of these things, writing songs that cross generations they can actually sing. Kind of revival of hymnody, I think, works well in our context. But what I would say is this. There was a worship war, and the charismatics won it. And your church probably worships like a Calvary Chapel in 1980. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? So I'm writing a new book. I'm writing a book called Entrepreneurial Evangelicalism and the Remaking of Protestantism. It's just a scholarly book, a look at from 1985 to 2005 and how things have changed. It's not all, you know, the great. There's a whole lot of unintended consequences. But I think ultimately, one of the things we have to recognize is that churches, every generation hates the music of the church that follows it, right? Moliere was said of Mozart's music that it had too many notes and it would need to lead to lust and madness in the listener. That's what it said. Now, I've played it around the house. It doesn't work. But young man's over there taking that note down. Appreciate that. But every generation does, right? And every generation actually condemns the music of the generation that follows it and says, you could never use this in church. It's a very famous musician by the name of Larry Norman. Anybody heard of Larry Norman? Okay. All right. So I called Larry Norman up before he died. And I said, Larry, I'm writing a book, including a section on music and how to choose music in church. And I said, you're kind of a big deal in this moment. He wrote, well, he didn't write the song. He repopularized the song, Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music? And he wrote such incredibly deep songs like, He's an Unidentified Flying Object. You will see him in the air. But he invented the genre that became contemporary Christian music. He was widely condemned for it. He was called gay and effeminate. He had long hair. He wore jeans, all this sort of stuff, back when those things were not like every single one of you. So big, kind of a big deal. So I talked to him and said, tell me what happened. Tell me the story. I wrote this all down for the book, and I'm about done. And he says, and I said, oh, but thank you so much, Mr. Norman. And yeah, whatever. And he says, I said, wait, before you go. I said, yeah. Let me tell you what I think about today's music. Just looks like a bunch of animals jumping up around there on stage. So I'm like, hello? With tattoos and nose rings. Who are these people? And how is this bringing glory to God? And I was thinking, hold on a second. John MacArthur wants to talk to you about you. Because, I mean, it's ironic but here's the thing. By the time his generation's come around, he's now opposed to the music of the next generation. I can't imagine what he would have thought of Lecrae. And I got to tell you, I love Lecrae, you know. And so here's the picture. The reality is every generation hates the next. So what happens is churches naturally tend to move away from more contemporary forms into more traditional norms if the congregation's older. Now, that can work well in some places. Tim Keller's church is a traditional church. Moody Church is a traditional church. Man, we had a pipe organ and an orchestra. And I was expecting multi-winged and multi-eyed angels to fly across the room during our song on Sunday. I mean, we were bringing it, crowned him with many. I mean, it was amazing, full choir, the whole nine yards. And I think maturity is to be able to worship in all different styles and approaches. But the reality is that the vast majority of churches that are growing younger and reaching younger adults are more contemporary than they are traditional. And in many of those cases, the senior adults sometimes feel left behind, or can say, I'm willing to sacrifice for the good of others, for my kids and my grandkids. So what I want to say, long answer to your short question, but there are several things that get there, is I think you probably need to skew a little younger, but don't try to chase youth culture. See the distinction between the two? Youth culture, you know, you don't need Justin Bieber worship, please. You know, if it sounds like that, it's doing it wrong. Something, some rich, some depth. You know, I came to Christ in the 70s, so the height of theological music was, do Lord, oh, do remember me, oh, Lordy. So I love the depth and the riches that are in depth. And so I've been a contemporary church pastor for 25 years. My daughter recently came to me. She's going to college at Wheaton College. She actually decided to go to Wheaton College 6 months before I decided to go to Wheaton College. So that was an awkward conversation. She's going away to school 500 miles away. And I said, hey, honey, guess what? We're coming too. And she says, seriously? Her exact words were, you people, called us you people, you people are moving to the town where I'm going to college? I said, yes, and I'm going to be on faculty, yay! And she called us the ultimate helicopter parents, just hovering around, She subsequently loves it, and she comes over, brings her friend over. It's all good. But she came to me recently, just very sad. She said, "Dad, I want you to know I decided I don't want to go to a church like ours." I was kind of like, "Why? What's the deal?" I was a little nervous what that meant. She going Arminian? I didn't know what exactly that. God forbid. She said, "You know, I'm a musician. You know, she's a classically trained opera singer. You know, sung nationally. That's what she's studying there." She says, "And I just can't take the 4-chord rock and roll anymore. So I'm going to go to College Church, which is right next to the school, and it's a verse-by-verse expository, reformed, theologically-driven church that's traditional." And she's like, is that okay? And I tried to think, "Baby, if you got to rebel, I guess that's the way I want you to rebel." I tried to look like it was a big deal so she wouldn't do other things. You know, I didn't want her to become a Lutheran. So there's still a little bit of a risk. But here's the thing. What happens is group movements like ours that are more traditional, my denomination is more traditional, they hear things like that and say, "Oh, there's a big move back to it." There's not a big move back to it. There's a few people like my kid and some others. So that's what we call a counter trend. The trend is to larger contemporary churches, and that's where young adults are going. So what I would actually encourage you to do most is to ask your older folks to be part of a journey that helps engage the next generation and say to them, and by the way, when those people who are 30 now, we're going to ask them to do the same thing when they're 50 and to kind of build that as an ongoing pattern. Again, don't chase after youth culture, but tend to skew more younger in your worship would be my answer, my suggestion. I think this first over here had a question? Thanks. Hope that was helpful. Long answer. Sorry.
I was just going to ask about the pace of change. Yeah. So you're talking about the church voting for different things, and then it seems as though it was almost brought in straight after that.
Yes, straight away.
Yeah. Is there an advantage to that over doing things gradually, or is it different for different situations?
It's very different for different situations. Keep in mind, the power distance between them and me was significant. So I was a professor at a world-renowned seminary they were asking for advice. You're probably going to be 27 years old going to a church that's been around 120 years. So it's a very different pace in those situations. I'm not saying you're 27. I'm saying you've got shoes that are 27. But anyway, it does take time, and a lot of times it takes willingness. And what I would say is, if you're going to do revitalization, you've got to be in for the long haul. So now, for me, I've never done that, but largely because I come in all those cases already with kind of with a self-confidence in some ways, but also with them sort of acknowledging that they're asking me to do some things. So my exhortation to people is that, sometimes people say, don't make any changes in the first year. It depends upon the situation in the church. If the church is doing okay, I might not make any changes for the first year. The church is in trouble. They're kind of expecting you to fix some things right away and lead out. So it's so situationally driven. So what I would say is, here's how I decide what change to make. I would early on look for changes to test two factors. Number one, kind of people see that it needs to be changed. And number two, I can lead about the change and it'll be a win. The congregation says, that was a great choice. Because once they see you as making great choices involving change, you're like, what next do you want to encourage us to consider? And so you build on that. And so that could happen 3 weeks in. I'll tell you that the first change I made is when that woman got up, Martha, and said, "This church is filthy." I actually went to Martha. Martha said, "We're never going to stand up at this church again and slam what somebody else is doing in this church. As a matter of fact, we're going to cancel concerns of the church from now on, and we're going to use that instead for time to pray and to pray for people who don't know the Lord." And so we transition that way. So try, and you don't have to like eliminate everything. Don't you don't have to kill sacred cows, but don't feed them. And then eventually they wander to other pastures. Stella, Alice, whatever her name was. Did you have a question? Yeah.
Can you do both? Can you have a contemporary service and a traditional service, more liturgical service, attracting two different groups of people? And if you do that, is there a danger of that doing something or saying something about your ecclesiology? I mean, I wouldn't have two services based on, one service exclusively for men who are bald and another service for men with long hair. And what is it that elevates worship style to such a level that it might be a good thing to have two different styles? Yeah. Or it might not be a good thing.
It's the first time in human history. So we're in uncharted waters here. So nobody 100 years ago was asking that question. There was nobody saying, I wonder if we need two worship styles, because they were just kind of worship styles. And they were culturally driven and shaped, right? The Maasai in Africa worshiped differently than the Europeans did in Germany. So you'd go place to place. But what happened is that in the mid part of the last century, music began to accelerate. And with accelerated change came accelerated shift. Now, I think that is slowing. So I do, and here's where it slowed, is that most churches, most growing churches, matter of fact, in the States, almost all growing churches, and my guess is the vast majority here, are now sort of on the other side of, and they're now more contemporary than they are traditional. Now, because musical style has sort of, there's not been a new genre created in decades, right? So you think maybe rap would be the last major genre. And pretty much all the genres that exist have been now are evident and present in some churches. So there's not this new, but that wasn't the case, right? So you go back 100 years ago, there's kind of a thing. It's churches worship this way. Now, you had multiple questions, all good, might I add. But one of them was, is it good to have more than one worship style? Okay, yes. Is it bad to have one worship style? Yes. I mean, two worship styles, yes. Here's why. There are consequences and opportunities with each choice. Okay, so at Moody Church, if I were to be the pastor at Moody Church, which is by no means going to happen, and I'm not interested in it, I'm at that stage where it's about 2 months in, and they're like, "Well, why don't you be our pastor?" And I'm like, "Because I don't want to be." I love you, but not it. But they'll say, and one of the things I say to them is because one of the first things I do is I'd start a contemporary service, because in downtown Chicago where we are, we need a bang on awesome traditional service like we have now. And it's good. I mean, it's good. You should come. I mean, pipe organ, orchestra, you know. I mean, Keith Getty calls me up and says, "Can I come and be a guest there?" And I'm like, no. You are not big a deal enough. So we don't. But why would I do that? Because where we are in Chicago, there's the elite Chicago, and then there's sort of the young hipster Chicago, and it's all right next to me. Now, some of them will come to the traditional service, but I actually think, as a missiologist, that it's a good missiological strategy for us to have a full-on contemporary service, which is kind of, you know, Keller sort of does this. They have a traditional service. I said they're traditional. They have a traditional service, but they also have a contemporary service and a jazz service. Mm-hmm. So they have all these different services that are there. Now, here's where it gets tricky, though, is that ultimately it can divide the church. Now, again, you can go full on Dever on this, and you should have one service only, not even a second service. You know, Mark Dever believes one service, one place where you all see one another. And I love Mark Dever, but I think that's just not helpful. But he's got reasons for it. You should listen to his reasons for it. You should always, you know, don't just blow someone off. Listen to why they're saying something. And it's a mark of maturity to listen to others' arguments, but I wasn't persuaded. So, but the church I pastor in Miami, I have to use numbers to explain this, but they're big numbers, and I want you to know that I'm doing this because you know that it's much easier to do it here in the States. So we have about 10,000 people on a weekend that attend a church where I'm teaching Pastor Miami. We have 9 locations via video. So some of our locations are very Latino. I mean, so the worship is in Spanglish. That's a thing. And we just go right back and forth between English and Spanish. Some verses are in Spanish. The Palmetto Bay campus, where was our broadcast campus, is actually the whitest campus. It's about 50% white, about 30% Latino, and then everybody else. And it feels different. So even in our, so the same preaching is broadcast, and some people don't like that, and that's fine. But the same preaching is broadcast, but the contextual expression is evident everywhere. My point is, I think you can, if you think wisely, and encourage people to go cross services. Like if I'm in a church that's contemporary and traditional, I'm like, I expect to see you at both services from time to time, because I want you to grow up. I want you to realize that this is. And you know what? When I say grow up, I'm not saying you contemporary people go to the traditional service. I think traditional people need to grow up and worship in contemporary ways too, because we have to have the maturity to move between cultural contexts. Now, my preference is not to do that, but I think there are not to have multiple styles. Is to have one style that tends to be more contemporary than traditional in my ministry settings. But again, I'm at Moody Church now. I would never end. Matter of fact, if I was in charge of Moody Church, I'd make our traditional service more traditional, and I'd have a contemporary service alongside of it, not the other way around. But it's got to remember, it's Chicago, and I got a whole orchestra feel there, you know, the whole nine yards. Good. And let me make sure that we don't go too long, because I want to do church planting stuff. I think we'll have to make this the last question, because I want to talk about some church planting stuff. You want to just do church planting? Okay. So he decided his question was not worthy of taking away from church planting stuff. So how do you accelerate church planting? How do you see church planting move forward in sort of a movemental way is what I want to talk about. You have some robust church planning. I want to affirm you for that. You have some robust church planning. Things are going well in the FIEC when it comes to church planning. What I want to focus on is how to help things go better in church planting, and specifically how to help facilitate and grow a movement in those areas. Now, in my lifetime, I've seen some movements have actually grown and accelerated over the years. And what I want to talk about is a little bit about them and kind of explain what we've seen. I wrote a book called Viral Churches, and in that book, we actually talk a little bit about some of the characteristics of movements that really explode. Now, now what I'm talking about, the explosive growth, I'm not talking about church planting movements around the world, though I'm thankful for them. But there are 34 Western industrialized democracies. You live in one, and I live in one. And there's no church planting movement in any of them in the way that missiologists like David Garrison describe. There are in Bangladesh. There are in China. There are in Cuba. There are places, and sometimes in majority world places and minority world peoples. Excuse me, let me rephrase that. In our place, in the first world, there are some majority world peoples who are actually experiencing church planting movements under our noses, but among majority peoples in 34 Western industrialized democracies, there's no church planting movement. A church planting movement is a rapid, reproducing, indigenous movement of churches that explodes within a given population group or a people segment. It's a remarkable thing to see. I've had the privilege of studying some of them, and it's really, really amazing. Ironically, for theological-minded people, they always become, well, maybe they're not doing this or this right. You know what? Just be thankful that tens of thousands of people come to meet Jesus and are planting churches in such a short amount of time. It's a remarkable, remarkable thing to see. But we haven't seen it here. Now, after these ideas first began to be just researched and termed church planting movements about 20 years ago, people said, well, let's try it here. And so what we've had is, I've been in London with workers who were trying to facilitate a church planting movement in London. And I actually have been. I joked earlier that I've only been to Hemsby. So I've only been to Hemsby on this trip. And I really, really, to be fair, don't you think you owe me a trip back? Maybe some of you in Birmingham or Glasgow, I've never been to those places, you know, and so maybe invite me back, we can hang out, share our feelings, and change the world together for Jesus. But what we did is I did a research project, and we've done research in the U.S., Australia, Canada, New Zealand, but not the U.K., which is a shame. The U.K. people couldn't get together a group of people to actually do a church planting study, which is grievous to me because the evangelicals, even the broad evangelicals, don't want to work with one another to do church planting research. Everyone says, well, we'll do it in our group. Well, we don't do it in your group. We want to do it on evangelicals. Another story for another day, but my mild prophetic rebuke hopefully is received in the spirit that's given. But I think we can draw some principles from Australia, from New Zealand, and some other places. And what we found is that when we do see movemental energy in a group of churches, they tend to have certain characteristics I want to share with them. First, they tend to be passionate about multiplying everything. So in other words, it's not just church multiplication, not just that this FIEC church is now planting this FIEC church, but they've already been multiplying things in their own church, in their own lives. So for example, they're multiplying disciples, they're multiplying groups, they're multiplying ministries, they're multiplying leaders, and so then it's just natural that they then be multiplying churches. So having a multiplication DNA is key to being a multiplying movement. But it starts at the local, it starts at the disciple level. It starts at your neighborhood. Maybe after this morning, you go home, you're going to draw a chart of your neighborhood. You're going to multiply as a disciple in your neighborhood. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And so that means you individually and personally have to model multiplication. You have to model that multiplication. And that leads to certain things, even as a church. So as churches are being planted, how many of your churches have planted within the last 3 years? Raise your hand for just a second. Anybody? Oh, a few of you. Great, great, super. I want to encourage you, as you're planted, and as other churches are planted out of FIEC churches, that you would be born pregnant. It's a strange phrase, but on the first day of your church, in the first meeting, have some sort of emphasis on church planting. When we planted Grace Church on the very first day, we said, listen, welcome everybody. Hey, we're a church planting church here at Grace Church. We're so glad that you're here. Matter of fact, the offering today is going to go to our first church plant, and we're going to get involved in our first church plant within our first year. And from very beginning, we were being born pregnant. We were a new church that was already planning to birth a new church. And in doing so, it sped up our multiplication. Actually, we didn't get to plant our first church in the first year. Took another year after that, but then we sent out two church planters out of our church. We've sent that family to Brazil that lives in my neighborhood. We're from our church. They're out planting. So we've actually sent three families out now in the 4 years of the life of the church into church planting. And not just a little bit like, hey, maybe go and we'll send you a few dollars, but really we funded them to go. They're part of an exponential growth that we desire out of our church. Now, one of the tricky things is the necessity to open more lanes. Now, you've been to grocery stores, right? You've been to, do you call grocery stores something different? Supermarkets. Thank you. It's fabulous. You go to the supermarket. Whenever I try to make an accent, I always turn into Mel Gibson in Braveheart. You know, which is so, it's like every accent is, freedom! And if you go to the supermarket, you'll find that there's like a bunch of checkout lanes, right? So you got checkout, these are like lanes that people got to go through, like between the chairs. And whenever I go there, there's like 20 lanes, one open, and 20 people in that one lane. You've been there, right? And I hate it. There's a simple solution. Open the lanes. Open more lanes. Well, church planting in the English-speaking Western world has a whole lot of people like, yeah, I'd plant a church if I had a fully funded job, fully funded salary. Well, the reality is we're not going to buy our way into a church multiplication movement. We're going to have to open up some more lanes. And so to really get to church planting, it means that you're going to say, I'm going to go get a job as a carpenter. I'm going to go get a job is blowing insulation. That's what I did when I planted my first church in Buffalo, New York. My denomination turned me down to be a church planter. I would have turned me down to be a church planter, to be perfectly fair. And later, I became the person for the denomination that turned down the church planters, or I would say approved them. But I got to tell you, I went anyway, and I got a job. Every time we see a rapid increase of church multiplication, it's when church planters stop relying on someone else to pay their salaries and find means to do it themselves. Now, I'm not opposed to getting paid. If you can do it, great. If someone's going to resource you, great. But you need to have a robust assessment, that whole nine yards that goes with that. But let me just say that to get to true movement, we're going to have people sending out other people who aren't going to be paying those people. I was talking to Johnny Crist. Johnny Crist leads the Atlanta Vineyard Church. Some of you know the Vineyard Church. Vineyard Church becomes an explosive movement, grows rapidly, hundreds of churches planted. John Wimber sent a lot of them out. Wayne Grudem, here's a fun fact for you. Wayne Grudem was the original theologian of the Vineyard. Bet you didn't see that coming. Not so much now. Johnny Crist said, so how'd you become a church planter in Atlanta? He said, well, John Wimber turned to me in 1982 and said, well, you're a businessman. You love the Lord. The Holy Spirit's on you. You've been growing. Why don't you go out and start a church in Atlanta? Johnny said, well, okay. Because nobody told him not to. Now, they would later develop the themes of education because some of you are like, oh, no, what about theological education? I was speaking to a group of Anglicans who had left the Episcopal Church. They want to plant 1,000 churches in their lifetime. Or in 5 years, not 5 years, 1,000 as a movement. And they asked me to talk to them, and I laid out this idea, and someone raised their hand who was head of one of their seminaries that was still Orthodox and said, Dr. Stetzer, how can we guarantee orthodoxy and the commitment of our people without theological education? You're telling us to send people out. It's irresponsible. And I said, if there ever was a group that should not be asking this question, because everyone in your whole denomination has an MDiv or more, and yet it's deeply heterodox, it's you. So, well, we can do it right. And I pointed back to an Anglican missiologist. I'm not even going to tell you what he said. I'm going to tell you the titles of his books. He was one of the most important missiologists of our day. His name is Roland Allen. Okay, here's the title of one of his books. It's called Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours. Just the title. I'm not making any comment. Number two, the spontaneous expansion of the church and the causes that hinder it. And number three, the case for voluntary clergy. I've just given you a lesson in missiology from Roland Allen's titles. So when we get to that, we find that churches are planted by people who have freedom to plant churches. And so to do that, we have to give permission. We have to say to people, we're going to give permission, space, and place for people to plant churches. We're going to hold the theological integrity in the movement and train people in place. This is key. I'm not saying that, it doesn't matter. Just, you don't have to have any theology. Just go on out and do it. No, it matters deeply. But we got to overcome fear with the idea that sending people out when they remain in community. I mean, praise God for the FIEC. Praise God for the theological depth. Praise God. Could some of you allow somebody to plant a church in a community next to you and you mentor him theologically? If you're going to get to rapid multiplication, defining missional well, that we're going to be on mission together and we're going to value these things as a movement. Finally, plant by multiplication, not by funding. If you're going to do this, you're not going to do it by having all the money in the world. You're going to do it by equally sacrificing across the movement. If FIEC churches are going to be planted across the UK and beyond, it's going to be because of the men and women in this room are willing to sacrifice from their church to send out people, say, we're going to help develop them. We're going to help theologically train them. We're going to partner with institutions to provide that kind of theological training, and we're going to sacrifice. In my lifetime, there have been 5 groups that have planted more than 1,000 churches in the lifetime of their founder. I want to be like one of them. And I want your church to be a part of that. The ingathering of God's people in churches that are being evangelized into existence across the UK and beyond is a beautiful thing. But it takes a commitment to church planning that so often is lacking, desired, but lacking. We're not going to get to a church multiplication movement in the current way. It's going to take a new way, a way of sacrifice, a way of theological passion and integrity with missiological direction and action. And I believe I'm up on my time. Thanks for the opportunity to share with you. God bless.